Sorry, a lawsuit forgot that to turn began that on. 2 years, actually 2 years ago. So in November of 2012, we filed a lawsuit, and that lawsuit basically challenged a ballot proposition that had passed. And we worked on that actually even before the ballot proposition passed, when it was still on the ballot, and we worked with ACLU. And as it turned out, we were a plaintiff in the case, as well as helping with the legal work behind the scenes. And let me tell you, that's a really nice place to be, because other times we've tried to get the attention of the ACLU and not been able to, but this time it did work. And so we were able to file the lawsuit the day after the election, and actually stop it from being enforced. And so it was filed the morning after. And if you all are going to do something like this, I can't stress any more strongly that it has to be done. You have to have all this planned well ahead of time if you're going to do something like this. So even though in your state you may or may not have ballot initiatives, you do have legislation that gets introduced, and you need to prepare sometimes for the fact that it's going to pass, even though you're very much opposed to it, like we were. And, you know, when the ballot proposition got put on, the way that it was worded was like motherhood and apple pie. And so, of course, anybody who would have voted against it would have looked like, you know, an enemy of the state. So once we realized and, you know, came to our senses that it was going to pass, then the question was, how do we stop it from being enforced? And the way to do that was, in fact, a federal lawsuit. And, again, the lawsuit was filed the day after the election and requested a temporary restraining order, which was granted. And, again, we're dealing with a case that was in federal court. It was filed in San Francisco. It could have been filed anywhere in the state of California. We chose San Francisco because there's a very liberal court in San Francisco, and we thought we had the best chance there. So another strategy point for people when you're going to do it, also pick, if you can, the location where you file a lawsuit. We have some very conservative parts of our state as well as very liberal parts of our state, and so we went ahead and went to the liberal. We got the temporary restraining order, and then that went to court for a preliminary injunction, and the preliminary injunction was also granted, and that continued the temporary restraining order, so there's never been enforcement of the provisions. And so then what happened just recently was a challenge of the preliminary injunction, and that challenge was unsuccessful, thank goodness. And so our preliminary injunction will continue until, in fact, we can get a ruling on a permanent injunction. So I don't know how many people that are listening, you know or care about the legal mechanics of what went on, but the great thing overall is that not only did the enforcement of this proposition get stopped, and by the way, the proposition was unclear, and I'm being kind there, about what would be required, but some people basically said anytime anybody on the registry ever used a computer or used the internet would have to report that to law enforcement. It was totally unmanageable. If you can imagine, if you bought a pair of socks from Amazon, that you might have to report that to your, you know, local law enforcement. And that's how, in fact, it could have been interpreted. So that vagueness was very helpful, too, in convincing the court that nobody quite knew what was going to be required. Law enforcement would be flooded with this information if it, in fact, were sent. But in addition to the ballot proposition being stopped in its tracks, quite literally, the other thing that was stopped was before, you used to have to let them know what your your email address was. And actually, the TRO and then the preliminary injunction after that went even farther than the ballot proposition. So at this point in time in California, law enforcement cannot, and I underline not, require anybody on the registry to provide any information about emails and any computer usage. And then, of course, there's exceptions if you're on parole or probation, but even those are limited. So maybe I should stop here and take any questions that people might have about this particular case. Of course, we have something even, well, at least as exciting to me that we've been doing in the course. But I'm going to stop right now about this in case anybody has a question.
Well, Janice, can I ask you some questions? Because I know a lot of questions that people will have. And California is unique in the ballot initiative. So could you kind of just explain that it's basically California citizens can put things on the ballot. And this was something that didn't go through the legislative process. Is that correct? It was a citizen initiative.
You can put citizen in quotes. So there is a very wealthy man who, Chris Kelly, who I believe made a whole lot of money working for Facebook. And so he spent millions of his own dollars to create this ballot initiative. So, yes, it's quote citizens, but you or me or, you know, the person down the street can't afford to do this. It really takes a wealthy individual.
Well, I understand. One thing you said earlier was that when people would, if they voted against this, they would be something to the effect that they would be criticized. But every citizen in California had a chance to vote on this, and, of course, it passed with a landslide because people thought it was great to manage sex offenders and allow them on the Internet.
Larry, I need to stop you right there because actually the bulk of this proposition had nothing to do with sex offenders and the Internet. It had to do with human trafficking for sexual purposes.
Yes.
And that's why we knew it was going to pass. Everybody's against that. And for some reason, they slipped in this other language. There are only about two sentences that had to do with sex offenders. And unfortunately, we were very concerned about, you know, what it would mean for anybody using the Internet.
Well, that is correct. Human trafficking was the big umbrella that this was under. But I want to toot your horn a little bit more in terms of what when a judge grants a temporary restraining order, that's generally done ex parte, only with the quality of the pleading that the lawyer brings in and says that we deserve this, and those are very very hard to get. And then when an injunction is granted, it's the judge basically playing their hands, saying. They've looked at the case, and the standard is a likelihood of success on the merits, and the judge has already tipped their hand that this case is likely to succeed on the merits in this court. So to get where this posture, the way this case is, with the injunction and with the TRO, is just a phenomenal achievement, and it's. Now I have a question about certiorari. I know that this is a Ninth Circuit decision. Is there a possibility, since I saw in that decision a very sweeping one sentence in there that says a sex offender no longer on supervision has the full right to anonymous communication? Is that something that's going to trigger a cert petition, Janice, or is a cert petition within the realm of possibility?
You know, I don't think so, Larry. Most courts like to do, I mean, that's part of the dicta, not really the main decision. And I think that as much as we would like that to go forward to the U.S. Supreme Court, I don't think it's going to, I don't think so. Well, but I will be happy to use that dicta in cases in the future.
Yeah, it's powerful dicta. I mean, we've got that for the entire Ninth Circuit, and that's how many states? California, Oregon, Washington, Montana, Idaho, Alaska, Hawaii. I mean, to make the proclamation that a sex offender who's completed their sentence has full right to anonymous communication, to me is quite sweeping.
Absolutely. We were very, very happy with this opinion because, you know, it went into such great depth. I mean, I'm looking at it right now, it's 41 pages long. And so, you know, they could have kind of dealt with it on the surface, but they didn't. And so they really delved into it, and they did talk about, you know, the scope of this was too broad. They talked about it violated First Amendment rights, acknowledging that, in fact, people on the registry do have First Amendment rights. It talked about, you know, people being on, you know, some people being on probation or parole, other people being well beyond that. You know, and remember, in California, we have the lifetime registry for everybody. So we have our, you know, people on a registry for 50-plus years. And so, you know, this would have just caused great havoc if, in fact, somebody would have to report to law enforcement every time they ordered a pair of socks on Amazon.
So, well, and I noted some troubling things in the decision also that helped to bring it down, what you've already covered in the overbreath, but they couldn't help themselves in requiring that the person do the reporting in writing by postal. And the opinion noted that access to a post office within 24 hours is very inconvenient. for some. And if they had made it maybe an electronic notification, that would have taken that sting out of it. But there was other problems. But I don't want to devour all the time. I know we've got a lot of people on the call, and I know you said you're pushed for time. So how much time have you got that you can allot to us?
I do have more time. I'm making a presentation later this evening about the Human Rights Act, I think. But anyway, I've got at least 15 more minutes.
And how many more minutes?
At least 15. Yes.
15, like 1-5?
Yep.
Okay. Well, did you want to take some questions or move on to another topic? Because we've got the 15 minutes. We can use however you want.
Okay. Well, yeah, I would like to also talk about something that's really important in California, and that is something called presence restrictions. So we have been working very hard to eradicate presence restrictions in our state. And, you know, what happened is, actually, a year ago, our board got together and we said, you know what, we're really tired of reacting to bad things that people do to us, and let's stop some of those. So, and really, you know, shifting the burden. So what we did is we decided that we wanted to get rid of presence restrictions in the state of California. We had presence restrictions on the state level, the county level, and the city level. And at the state level, there are only a couple of them. And, you know, as annoying as they were pretty tailored. So, for example, if you're on parole and if your victim was 13 or younger, you couldn't go to a park or a park or a school without your parole officer's permission. But what happened is that we had some cities that went crazy with that, and they decided that they were going to, in some cases, tell people on the registry they couldn't go to the movie theater, and they couldn't go to the swimming pool in the summer, and they couldn't go, I mean, all these places, and really could not go through, in some cases, the drive-through at McDonald's. So we decided that we're mad as hell and we're going to do something about it. And so we have now filed 25 lawsuits in 2014, and we're taking a little breather right now trying to get some of these cases settled. But the fact is that we really have made a huge difference, and I'd say by the end of this month we will have very few ordinances left. And when we filed a lawsuit, the only way we would settle the lawsuit is either if they repealed their ordinance entirely, or if they, in fact, would revise it to reflect the state law. Some of the cities said, well, we have to have something on the books. So we said, well, if you basically parrot the state law, there's nothing we can do about that because we haven't challenged the state law yet. So I share that with people because I want you to have hope and know that what I call the pendulum of punishment can be stopped. And also, you know, it's an important message to send to elected officials, because elected officials for so long have passed new laws, and there was no downside to passing a new law. And many of them thought they would either get elected or reelected if they passed one more law that would restrict something about a sex offender's life. And so what we've proven to them now is that there is a downside, and what we found in this election year, that we had no new laws being passed by these cities and counties that had passed them in the past.
Well, they've got old Belucci filing a lawsuit every week. So.
Oh, it's every other week, Larry. But still, I've been very busy doing that, and it's had the impact that we hoped. So I'm willing to answer questions about that. And I think the last topic I'd like to bring up is residency restrictions. And our state Supreme Court had been sitting on two cases, one case for 2+ years and another case for over 4 years on residency restrictions. They finally scheduled oral argument, and that was held last week. And now we're expecting two decisions to come down. They have to come down within 90 days. I think it's quite likely it'll be in early January, because we have one justice who's retiring who heard the case. And after listening to the oral arguments, we actually are optimistic that they will at least be limited to registrants while on parole, and it's even possible they may overturn them completely. One reason that we're so optimistic, quite frankly, has to do with the questions some of the justices asked, including, was just amazing, they actually asked the question more than once, is this punishment? So,
wonderful.
That was very good to hear.
we do have one question, Larry, waiting in the queue. So whenever you're ready, let me know.
Let's take it.
Okay.
Hi, Janice. This is Michael. Michael in Indiana. How are you doing tonight?
Doing well, Michael.
Good. Hey, I've been watching the California case, the internet case, really closely because I was convicted in 2011 of a failure to register simply because I did not provide internet identifiers. And so I filed a suit, and it's sitting in the U.S. District Court in South Bend, Indiana, basically waiting for that case to get taken care of. So now I've informed them that that this decision has come through, and I'm hopeful that that will affect what I filed with the habeas corpus there. So I'm kind of wondering how you feel this is going to roll out across the country. And secondarily, I was told that under Adam Walsh, the Facebook restriction, because Facebook prohibits sex offenders from having a Facebook, that actually even if your state allows you to have a Facebook, that they could still prosecute federally under that. And I was wondering if you could speak to that.
Okay. Well, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision is precedent and certainly can be used in other states. And even though Indiana is in a different circuit, that can be brought to the court's attention and say, look, the Ninth Circuit says I have a First Amendment right here. So whether it's persuasive or not remains to be seen. I really don't know, what your circuit has said on this topic. And then your last part of your question had to do with Facebook. And Facebook is a different, different in that it's a for-profit company. And for-profit companies that don't accept money from governments can discriminate all they want to, and they've chosen to discriminate against sex offenders. So I don't know how to unpeel that onion. Maybe Larry has an idea or two, but I think that they actually are able to do that with impunity.
But can the federal government prosecute based on the private companies? I mean, they could shut you down, but can the federal government prosecute based
I can't answer that. There is no prohibition in the Adam Walsh Act for a sex offender to be on social networking, period.
Nope.
Thank you, Larry.
So, now, there is an encouragement under there was an act, I forget what it's called, in 2008, where they created a dumping a platform for all the registrars to dump their internet information in, and identifiers and all the things that sex offenders provide, and social networks are invited to use that free of charge so that they can purge their list of sex offenders. But there is no federal law that prohibits you from being on Facebook or any other social network.
Not specifically. What I had heard is that the federal law says that if you have to be in compliance with the individual company's guidelines.
You ask the person to give you the citation for that and get back to me, will you?
Okay. All right. Do that. Thank you. Appreciate it.
All right. Next question.
It was a Facebook question as well, and it was mostly answered. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. That's all the questions we have. There's been a lot of people come on new. If you have questions for Janice, you'd use a *6 to ask your question. And
while we're waiting for questions, maybe I can add that, I would encourage every state to find yourself a civil rights attorney who, in fact, would be willing to file lawsuits. And I have, I have documents that I've drafted and that have been filed in federal court. And the great thing is because they've been filed in federal court, they can be filed in your state as well in federal court. So I try, in fact, to stay away from my state court. Our state court judges don't have the backbone that our federal judges do, in large part, because federal judges are appointed for life, and most state court judges face election. And because of that, they're not as brave in general.
Okay. All right. We do have another question here. Go ahead. if she's willing to speak. Kathy, did you put yourself on mute as well?
Of course I did.
There you go.
Hey, just a quick question. I know my son's federal, so a little bit different than a lot of the people who are dealing with the state stuff. But we're fixing to face quite a few things as he comes home in May. Residency restrictions we've already hit, but I think we've overcome that hurdle. But the next one is going to be for internet access and some of those things. You said to find a civil rights attorney. Can you file, because even though you're in California, can you file things from a federal standpoint here?
No. No, you have to be a member of the State Bar Association to do that. So,
okay.
And the other thing is, since you said your son is in the federal system, I would assume he's going to be on federal probation. And it's actually, at least in California, it's easier to go back into court federal probation than it is state parole. It's a much quicker process. There's quite a line of cases out there, and I'm more familiar with California and the Ninth Circuit, but there's quite a line of cases out there that tell people that they can, in fact, be granted use of the computer, provided that a monitor is put on the computer. So that's something that I would encourage you and your son to check in with a probation officer about. He or she may or may not be familiar with monitors on computers, but that's one way a lot of people have been given access to computer usage, and more specifically to the internet.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I might email you. I have some other questions because we've got a pretty lengthy list of restrictions. So, and we are going to go challenge those. It's just a matter of timing, and our federal judge, short of dying, is actually taking senior status in January. But we're not sure exactly what that's going to mean for us. So.
Okay. Yes. Do you have my email address?
No. If you'll give it to me, I'd appreciate it.
Okay. It's J for Janice, M as in Madeline, Bellucci, which is spelled in two parts, Bell, B-E-L-L, Ucci, U-C-C-I, @AOL.com.
Thank you. I will shoot you some questions. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. And when I mentioned the federal lawsuits before, I want to say that I'm willing to share what I have filed, and an individual can file them on his or her own behalf. You don't have to have a lawyer, though you'll get better results if you do have a lawyer, but having a document like I have will help reduce the cost significantly.
Janice, can I ask you a little bit about the ACLU? It's been one of the things that comes up most often is about the ACLU, and the ACLU is working very closely with you on this case. But this is a First Amendment case, and they have gotten involved in First Amendment cases with sex offender restrictions, like in Louisiana and Indiana, some other cases, states. Is that not driven by the fact that they see the potential for fee recovery and likelihood of success? Does that not play into their consideration that they can get involved in First Amendment easier than they can a general challenge to registration?
The easy answer is yes.
Okay. So
yeah,
I just want people to understand that is a consideration they have to – I mean, they do take that in consideration if they can prevail and collect fees and keep their doors open.
Right. And I'll say that with the lawsuits that we filed with regard to presence restrictions, we've also been able to collect attorney's fees. And so what happened is that, you know, we had actually two families that donated – you know, it was a X number of dollars to the cause. And I remember when I approached them, I said, we'd like to file 7 lawsuits. And, you know, we were thinking real big then, we thought. And so 7 lawsuits. And so with the money that they provided, we've actually been able to multiply it and turn it into 25 lawsuits because the early lawsuits we were able to get attorney's fees from. And so we turned around and, you know, file the next 7 until we got to the number 25.
And the attorney fees are coming as a result of being prevailing party in the civil rights action in federal court.
You know, Larry, we never got to the point. There's one case that may be different, but of the others, so far, it's the cases have settled. And,
well,
you know, most cases
settle. You're settling. Yeah. They accepted the fact that they're probably going to lose. But I'm saying you're in federal court, and there's a provision of, for prevailing parties. Is that provision in state court in California? I know in New Mexico, each party is responsible for their own attorney's fees, and there's no provision like there is under Title, what is it, 42 U.S.C. 1983 for the prevailing. Can I don't want people to think it's an automatic grant of attorney's fees, no matter what court you're filing in. So that's what I'm trying to clarify. That attorney's fees are a driving factor because you have to keep your doors open.
Right, but. Again, we filed in federal court. We have complaints for federal court. The same complaint with a few changes could be filed in any other state in federal court. And our state court, you know, California is liberal in its laws, and so we do have something similar to, 42 U.S.C. 1983 in our state law. But again, we choose to go a federal route because we have judges who are braver, have more courage.
Well, they have the independence of not going up for retention. They're on for life, and they can only be removed and by impeachment. It's a very difficult process, and there's judicial independence in the federal court that very few states can come close to having.
That is true.
You're welcome, Janice, to stay with us as long as you can. Is there any more questions, Brenda, on the consult?
I have two more. Are you able to handle two more, Janice? Neglected to look at the timing. Okay.
Okay.
I have Mark on here. I think if this is actually Mark.
Yes. Hi, I'm from Connecticut, and I don't know how common this is, but one of the conditions of probation and parole here. Is they will not let you go to church until such time as you successfully pass a sexual history test, which could take forever. And is that a violation of civil rights that they're preventing you from practicing religion?
In California,
and has anybody taken that up?
I don't know about anybody, but I think in California that would be very blatant violation of constitutional rights. Absolutely.
But nobody's taken it up where there's sort of a template out there that could be worked from?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Janice, I'm itching for that issue. That has arisen in Maryland and some other places, and I'm itching to fight that battle.
Call Larry.
Where do you need to fight it from, Larry?
Well, there's a question of whether or not you have standing on the threat of enforcement. We would need to do some research to find out if you're within a zone of enforcement or whether you would actually have to be facing prosecution. You know, you've got different standards when it comes to First Amendment. So we would need a legal professional, but I would argue that if it's on the books, you're within a zone of enforcement if you're registered in Connecticut. So you would.
Well, it's a condition of probation that you can't go anywhere where children might be, and they expand it to include, well, there's kids in a church, and so you can't go to church.
Yeah, you have less protections while you're being punished than you do, and the Ninth Circuit decision, they did a good job walking through the various levels of post-prison, of total freedom and parole and probation. They did that. So you have less assertion, and there are some case law out there in terms of how they can restrict your right to worship, but they have to give you access to worship, and I don't know how large the walls they can build around that. But I'm itching to fight a battle, a very clean battle, where the person can't worship, and they've completed all of their punishment, and they're just simply registered. That's the battle I'm anxious to fight.
Well, it's the issue of it's probation and parole, where your rights are somewhat restricted. But I thought the freedom to practice religion was just a universal that, you know, you got that right, that they can't take that away from you, because that's clearly punishment, but it's a restriction that's only while you're on probation or parole.
Well, there are cases out there that says that they can put some restrictions on you. It can't be a blanket prohibition. It's kind of like the internet. The question that the lady raised from whatever state, if they totally tell her son he can't be on the internet, that has already been clearly found unconstitutional. But they can restrict you in terms of your worship while you're being punished. If you were in prison, would you not be restricted on your worship?
I think the prisons provide better facilities to worship than on the outside.
You do have restrictions. At your various levels of punishment, they can do some restrictions, but that would have to be unpacked further than what we can do on this call. But I'd love to chat about it.
Thank you.
And I'd love you to take it up.
All right. Got time for the last one?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. You're on.
One more. Yeah. Hi, this is Ellen from Texas. One quick question, Janice. If we want to read more about this proposition that you were talking about earlier, our initiative, is there an identifying number on it, or how would we access that?
We have comprehensive information about it on our website. So the website is California spelled out, R-S-O-L, and .org. We have a search, a box, and if you type in prop, P-R-O-P, and then 35 was the number, you'll get to it. And we have all the legal documents right there.
Great, thanks. One other quick question about follow-up on this. Chris Kelly, what do you see? Is he going to be fighting you from here forward for the enforcement, trying to get this enforced, or what? Is he going away?
Yeah, he has been fighting us every step of the way. And, the man is literally a billionaire. And so, if he chooses to, take out, not play a few games of golf, I think he can afford to fight this fight. But the good news is he's lost at every level. And so I know that about 2 weeks ago I was, a radio station wanted to interview me, and Chris Kelly was supposed to be on the radio, and at the last minute he backed out.
You have him running scared.
I don't know about that, but, I just don't think he likes opposition. I think he wants to do things his way, and he can. And he got the sex trafficking proposition passed, and there's all kinds of rumors here that he wanted to run for attorney general of our state and wanted to get his name known. Mm. And, he may have already achieved his objectives, and he really doesn't care if this gets passed or enforced or not. I don't know.
Well, we in Texas are watching California carefully, and we appreciate all your hard work very much. Thank you.
You're certainly welcome. And I know you have a good attorney out there, too. I know his first name is Richard. I forget what his last name is. But
he's
been fighting
the
good fight, too.
Yeah, he's doing some good stuff. Yeah. And thank you.
You're welcome. Okay, on that, I will bid you all adieu and get on to my next meeting. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Janice. Right. Thank you for coming in.
Bye-bye.
So now I can get down to how many people on the line?
I'd say we've hit 50.
50. Okay. Well, 50. Welcome everybody who has joined since the initial welcoming started when we began the call, and we've got other things on the agenda, and everybody that should be in listen only mode, so we don't hear your freight trains and vacuum cleaners and everything that's running in the background. And we're going to go through and hopefully take more questions. And I don't know how long it's going to take. Are there any more questions that related to the topic before we move on? Because I always feel like I leave people behind that have questions. If anybody
our
feels
queue
like
was,
they have...
Our queue was clear, Larry, at least as of that moment.
Okay. So everybody was satisfied, apparently, with where we were on that. So we've got the... the excitement from Maryland, and then hopefully we can get to some national stuff that we are doing and have been doing to report to you guys, and then if everyone is still wanting to stay on the line, we can talk to one another about what's going on in our states. And the next call in January, we're going to concentrate a lot on what's going on in the states because legislative sessions are about to begin. On those states that have part-time legislatures, which are the majority of our states, and we're going to hear about from next month. So I'm going to ask you guys that want to talk about your states to be thinking about what you want to come in and tell us the horrible legislation that you know about and what you're planning to do about it. And if there's any way we can help one another with the expertise that we have in various states that have fought some of these battles that you may be facing. So the next thing on the agenda is Maryland, and we have Brenda Jones, who's the president. That's Janice. Brenda Jones is the executive director of Maryland's affiliate, which is called FAIR, Families Advocating Intelligent Registries. She's also the executive director of National RSOL. And I have been with Brenda Jones for how long now? We've been working together Mothers Against AWA, soon to be 5 years. You guys started in December of 09, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was about December. I don't think I got you on board until January, though. But.
Yeah, so it was Mothers Against AWA was the we've worked together, and Marilyn has built a great affiliate of RSOL, and we've done some great things. And Brenda and I are going to try to share what's happened in Maryland. They passed a great law in 2010 that took effect October 1st, and we were very new. I traveled to Maryland to Annapolis. Brenda went there a number of times, and there were 80 something bills pending that year because of a high profile case. And they, by golly, they're going to ramp up the registry and put everybody on lifetime every 90 days. And Brenda, tell us what happened as a result of that.
Yep. Well, the end result, of course, was that that law did in fact pass. That AWA and Maryland's flavor thereof, and pretty shortly thereafter, a fellow whose actual name remains anonymous, but he goes by John Doe, filed a challenge. He had actually been challenging him having to register for some earlier laws, but he started appealing and saying, "Now look, this is punishment, and my crime predates registration altogether. I should not be on here because that's ex post facto punishment." And it was starting around. He was actually based it on due process. He didn't actually base it on ex post facto originally. Bill of attainder, if you know what that is. Equal protection. Those were all the things that he was fighting. But when his case was heard, the state said that, and by the way, they added, it doesn't violate ex post facto constitutional restrictions because, we know about the 2003 case, and that just proves that the registry isn't punishment. So, that's the end of the discussion. But they brought it up then. So then when he lost and appealed, we were able to draw that back in. And that's about when FAIR and our attorney here got involved, which was a little later in 2010. We were able to start pulling in the ex post facto argument. And FAIR's involvement with the ex post facto argument was with the, we were a part of an amicus brief, which for those who are not familiar with the term, that means friend of the court. It's an extra statement that's much like what the lawyers do when they're presenting their arguments, but the amicus get to come in and make the arguments that the actual plaintiff doesn't necessarily is not actually able to because they're restricted to whatever affects the plaintiff. We're able to come in, and we were able to say, here's all the reasons it's punishment. Here's all the reasons that that there are problems, and hit all the things that they weren't able to. And Larry was a big help with that. He helped us locate. We had about a dozen people, who members of FAIR, who all wrote affidavits describing what was punitive about our registry. And then I wrote one as well and pointed out a number of things having to do with family members, for instance, suffering from ostracism, bullying. Almost everybody mentioned the inability to travel freely in our affidavits, which is something that, for example, that Mr. Doe couldn't really put in his case because he didn't travel. Yeah, so he was limited somewhat to mention it. He could have said, well, if I traveled, this would be a problem. But he couldn't say, I traveled, and it was a problem. So we were able to hit things like that, and list all those things out with Larry's help. And when the decision came out, we were referred to, so that was a good thing. The decision actually came out in March of 2013. Our Court of Appeals, which is our Supreme Court, declared that that requiring John Doe to register for a crime committed prior to the existence of a public registry was unconstitutional, retroactive, and they didn't really use the word punishment. We talked about prior restrictions in Maryland, but based on the Maryland Constitution, it was ex post facto punishment. We'll just call it that. And therefore, he should be removed. It was a plurality decision, which is to say it wasn't like everybody gave the same result. We had three judges who said it was based on the state constitution. Two judges said it was based on the national constitution. Another one said it had to do with his plea agreement. Only one judge actually dissented. So just about everybody all agreed that it was ex post facto punishment. They just disagreed on how to state it. Interestingly, it took another, I think it was about 90 days before the state removed Doe, because they were fighting. They said, oh, what about federal law? What about federal SORNA? And at first, the attorney, Ms. Forster, was going, oh, my God, now we're doomed. And again, Larry came in to our aid and helped us to draft some responses, and he can explain a little better what those are, to tell the trial court to force them to, and in the end we basically had to file for a show cause because they weren't going to take them off. But we gave Ms. Forster the language that they should use, which was that Doe should be removed from not just from Maryland's registry, but very clearly all other public listings, such as the NCIC, the national list. And the state did take Doe off finally, but it really ticked them off that we were telling them all other listings. And as a result of that, they tried to come back and get another bite at the apple. They couldn't really appeal. They didn't want to appeal nationally, but they said, we want to clarify this a little bit. Now, can you explain again, please, about this federal thing? Don't we need to keep him on there? Because the feds want people like him to be listed on the registry, so don't we need to keep him on? And they tried to come back and get this clarifying question. Well, the Court of Appeals agreed to hear that, that they turned around the question. They agreed to hear it, and Ms. Forster again was not real sure how to argue this, and we helped a lot. We, meaning Larry mainly, helped a lot behind the scenes to set up what the arguments would be in this decision. They were trying to say, well, can we do this? But instead, the Court of Appeals turned the question around and said, do circuit courts have the authority to order the state to remove sex offender registration information from federal databases? And so they twisted it around and turned this is a state authority thing. Can the state tell the feds what to do? And we all know where people tend to come down on that. So we were feeling real good about this even before we went into argument. They dubbed this Doe 2, and when the decision came down on that argument, it was no longer Mr. Doe should come off the registry. It was, hell yeah, Mr. Doe should come off the registry. And as long as they're in Maryland, as long as anybody is in Maryland, they cannot be required to register as sex offenders, notwithstanding any that are imposed by SORNA. So in other words, yes, the state can do this. And anybody else similarly situated. So we went from just Doe to anybody in the state that that fits that description. So,
Larry,
you're itching to fill in some gaps there, I can tell.
Yeah, I could. Yeah, well, also watching the time clock. But, yeah, you've done a good job telling the essentials. The state litigated with every type of imaginable litigation, trying to avoid removing Doe, the original Doe, from the registry, and they ended up having to remove possibly as many as 3,000 because they couldn't afford to let Doe go. They fought so hard, and in my view, with some very unethical tactics to try to maintain. Basically, they didn't want to do what the state's highest court had ordered in Doe number one in the first decision, and we ended up having to do a motion for an order to show cause to do, and it would take too long to explain all the mechanics of what we went through, but there was a strategy of whether or not we would go back to the state's high court or whether we would let the trial court handle it. We elected to go back to the trial court on an order to show cause. And when threatened with contempt, they finally did remove him, and then they appealed the overbreadth of the order that Nancy and I had written, and I threw in some parts that was really gave the state consternation, which was to remove Mr. Doe from the NCIC, because the NCIC is what would cause you problem if you get pulled over in another state and they run your information. The NCIC, if a local agency has you registered, that pops up in the NCIC as an officer hit to the officer that the person is listed as a sex offender, and then they ask you how long have you been in that state. So I insisted that be in the order, and so they were saying that the judge didn't have the authority to order someone removed from a state from a federal database, and that was an overbreadth argument and ultimately we prevailed on everything and getting relief to how many people. Didn't you, Brenda, say about 3,000 are going to ultimately come off?
That is the word that I heard from Department of Public Safety. We're still waiting to see if they're really going to come through with it, but that's the theory. So far, I think we've had several hundred come on.
So there are a lot of gaps because there's so many years went by in this. But you know, when they were passing this law, we stood there and told them in Annapolis that this was unconstitutional. And we tried to urge them not to do it, and they did it anyway. And one of the senators, Senator Haynes, said, if there's anything unconstitutional about this, I wish someone would tell me. And we did, and of course it didn't do any good. And is Haynes still in office, Brenda?
I think we told you so. I think he retired.
The moral of the story is that one person who felt and also had some resources backing him up, felt that this was an unconstitutional thing to put him on the registry for a crime that occurred prior to in existence, and he continued to fight. He happened to meet up with Ms. Forrester, who actually saw his case working its way up, and she wanted it when she wanted the case, and she asked the lawyer, the trial attorney, could she join the case? And then Ms. Forrester worked with us, And we worked very well together. Then the public defenders of Maryland came in and helped. And we had a great collaboration with the public defenders and Fair and Nancy, and we stayed with it. And ultimately, a lot of people's lives are going to be saved. Is it going to end registration in Maryland? No. They didn't say you couldn't have a registration scheme. They said that it couldn't be applied retroactively to people whose crimes predated the registry, and then they said that the registration could not be increased during the duration of the registration. They couldn't change all the requirements, and a lot of people went from 10 years to lifetime, and they said that was a change that wasn't permissible, so a lot of people are going to see their 10-year terms restored. So, but it's not going to end registration. But these type of things encourage us to keep going, because when we get that notch in the apple that there's a determination that there's a limit, then we're going to go back and try to come at it from a different angle on something else and try to take off another branch of the tree. So we're not going to just pack up and go home. Matter of fact, Fair is working with Ms. Forrester on another lawsuit to try to bring off more people. So this is going to be a long-term project, and Maryland has just begun, and hopefully other states see what's going on in Maryland, has happened in Oklahoma, what's happened in Kansas. I don't think Kansas court has ruled yet, but there is litigation successfully taking place around the United States, and your state could be next if we just get the right mixture of people, the right plaintiff, the right combination of resources to go forward. Do you want to do questions,
Larry,
Brenda?
I would add to that as you have told me, I'm quoting you probably here, that, I mean, there's some states where the registry is bad, but not as bad. And so part of it is not just finding the right plaintiff, but also the right situation, where things have been applied heavily retroactively and it's considerably worse now that it got applied. So there's a lot of different, but the main thing is to have somebody that's willing and able to step forward. I would agree with that. We do have a question. When you're ready.
Yes, I'm ready for a question.
Okay. Let me wake him up here. There we go.
Hi, Larry. Mark from Connecticut. How are you?
Hey, Mark.
Question for you on Maryland. So Doe is no longer registered in Maryland, but he's still registered on the federal database, correct? That is not correct. So they pulled him off there as well.
There is no separate database. I'm sorry, Larry.
I'm going to walk you through that. When you say federal database, there are two federal databases. There's the Drew Shadeen website where they merely connect all the state registry websites together. And if that's what you're talking about, once he was no longer on Maryland's public registry, he was no longer on that Drew Shadeen website because that.
Right, that's an aggregation of. I've seen that.
Okay, but then the other issue is. When a registering official puts a person on the registry, they enter them in the NCIC, much like they enter a warrant, much like they enter a missing person. I think there's like 19 or 21 files in the NCIC. Registered sex offenders is one of them, missing persons, wanted persons, firearm permits, on and on and on. What we had the order say was that the registering agency, whatever local agency was registered with, was ordered to remove that entry that they had put into the NCIC. So he's no longer in the NCIC as a registered sex offender.
Okay.
Now in the NCIC, just like when they remove a warrant, if your local agency puts a warrant in the NCIC, once they serve that warrant, they remove it from active status. But the fact that there was a warrant issued is still in the NCIC. The feds don't ever let go of a shred of information once they've had it. So the fact that he has been registered, the federal government will never forget that. But he's no longer actively listed in the NCIC. So if an officer comes across him in another state and queries the NCIC, it won't pop up registered sex offender.
Now, when people's registration expires, does it become, for lack of a better word, inactive on the on that database?
The same process would have to take place. If a person's period of registration expired, the local agency that entered it would have to remove it.
Okay.
It would stay active until it's removed. And agencies who have operator, reporter, identifies, ORI numbers, and they've been trained and certified to put information in CIC, they're obligated to keep the information accurate. So if it's like a warrant, once it's been served, they're supposed to remove it. If the registration term has expired, then the NCIC should that active listing should be removed.
Okay, thank you for the clarification. And the other question is for the travel restrictions that people are faced with in Maryland. Is that unique to Maryland, or are you just talking about out of state travel?
It is not unique to Maryland per se. In the Adam Walsh Act itself, the states are encouraged to, as for compliance purposes, this is not a particular section that will deem sufficient that if you don't put it in, that they will still grant you compliance. But if a sex offender is going to be out of state for 7 or more days, they're supposed to provide advance notice to the registering agency and an itinerary. My contention has always been that providing any advance notice of travel is a prior restraint on travel, because if you are required to give notice and an itinerary, that means when grandma calls and says, I'm on my deathbed, come quick, and you don't know if it's going to take her 7 days or 10 days or 3 days to die, you can't go because you'd be out of compliance. So therefore, you're restrained. And if you're driving a truck, you don't know how many days it's going to take you to make the run, or if you're going to do a cross country trip to the Grand Canyon from Maryland, you don't know where you're going to stop, so you can't provide an itinerary. So I've always maintained that that's a prior restraint on travel. So in terms of the affidavits, when I wrote the affidavits, I focused heavily on that. The people actually didn't write their affidavits; they provided their stories to me about how they felt the registry was. We told them what we were looking for, and then they wrote their stories, and then I converted the story to an affidavit in terms of what the court would be looking for, and how they would want to hear it. So yeah, people just wrote their stories. That's what happened. But Maryland's not unique in that. A lot of states have that. A 7 day, if you're going to be absent from your state more than 7 days, you have to give advance notice for the absence. Alabama even says you have to get a travel permit to leave the state of Alabama for any period of time. And of course, nobody in the United States of America that's not on probation or parole should have to get a permission to travel.
Correct.
You have an
sure.
absolute constitutional right to travel. But if you're in Alabama, that hasn't been challenged yet, you go get a travel permit. You tell your friendly sheriff that you're leaving to out of the state, and they give you permission to travel.
Wow. So, thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. We have another question. Are you
there? Is Kathy.
There you are.
Yay. On the travel side, you know, on federal, you have to ask permission to travel no matter where you're going if you're leaving the jurisdiction.
Well, now clarify. Are you talking about a person who's on supervision or a person who's not?
A person who's on supervision.
Okay, and that's a whole different arena, because a person who's being supervised, they're still being punished, and it's quite common, whether or not you're a sex offender or whether you're a regular offender, you have to get permission to travel when you're being punished. That is nothing unique about that.
What? Except that in Texas, for the majority of federal, it's a lifetime. So,
what's lifetime?
Supervision.
Yeah, the supervised release is for lifetime. In my state, there are people who get lifetime supervision from federal, but it's not everybody. It's a whole lot of people do not get lifetime supervision. So I do very little federal practice in terms of the lawyers I work with. I'm primarily in state court, so I'm not going to say what the percentage is of people who end up with lifetime supervision, but I can tell you from experience I have, it's certainly not all of them. So, for those who do have lifetime supervision, The traveling is definitely a problem, and there are states who have lifetime supervision for sex offenders. I don't know if we have anybody from New Jersey, but I know they have community supervision for life. I think Colorado has an extremely long period. We have a very long period in New Mexico for it's an indeterminate period of 5 to 20 or 5 to life, depending on your offense. So it's definitely, travel is a problem for people who are being punished, but you don't have the same constitutional rights when you're being punished as you have when you're not. So is it good public policy? Probably not, to be that strict. But do you have a constitutional argument? You have a very weak constitutional argument because you're being punished for commission of a crime.
Okay.
That wasn't a very popular answer. So, yeah, and sometimes it's hard to distinguish between what something is bad policy versus something that is grounded in constitutional, in the Constitution. And I try very hard when I do presentations to say that something that's a bad policy is not necessarily unconstitutional. And I'll give an example of that. Lawmakers make bad laws all the time. They're not unconstitutional, but they're bad from a policy perspective, and they have every right to make that. Make a bad public policy, and your remedy is to not elect those people. If you don't like the law, that make it simply a bad policy. They could make a law tomorrow that says that no one could drive more than 45 miles an hour on interstate highways, and there's not anything unconstitutional about that, but it would certainly be bad policy. We'd have a lot of accidents. We would have inefficiencies in our economy, and commerce would slow to a crawl. But that wouldn't be a constitutional challenge that could be asserted. On the other hand, if they were to make a law that said that women could drive no greater than 45 miles an hour, and men could drive 70 miles an hour because they're better drivers, then you would have a constitutional argument because you've gotten into the equal protection area where they've got unequal application of the law. So, in terms of prisoners' rights, when you're in prison, then you go on post-prison supervision, you're still being punished until they finally discharge you from the totality of your sentence. You're still in a punishment mode, which affords you fewer rights in terms of your search and seizure, fewer rights in terms of your travel, fewer rights in terms of your associations. And so the question is, when we made the policy, when we elected people who made the policy of lifetime supervision, when they passed the law that said certain offenses generate a lifetime of supervision, did we make a bad choice on who we elected? Because they have the lawmakers have the total prerogative to affix punishment, and the only thing that the only area where the Constitution comes into play on punishment is whether it's cruel and unusual. And if putting people to death by needle, I usually use the electric chair as an example, but very few people get electrocuted anymore. But if putting people to death doesn't violate the cruel and unusual clause, then it's hard to imagine that very many things would violate the cruel and unusual clause. And our current Supreme Court believes that the cruel and unusual clause is applied based on what our founders would have thought as cruel and unusual at the time that they drafted the Constitution. And the cruel and unusual punishments were mostly physical. If what people would have thought would have been cruel and unusual in the times that the founders wrote the Constitution. So, go ahead. Next, is there any other questions?
Nope, I don't have any. Unless anybody else, for those who might have come on late or forgotten, you can star 6 if you have a question for Larry or for me, mostly for Larry if it's legal. But so far, no other questions. We've obviously just wowed them all with this wonderful news. Might be a good time to go ahead and move on. We did have a couple of people hopped on real quick here now that they remembered it was star 6, so let me bring the first one on. One of them disappeared. Let me try again. There was the name Ed was on that. I don't know if I accidentally got rid of you or if you just changed your mind. But I have this person here. You better introduce yourself. Hello.
Can I ask my question?
Yep,
go ahead.
Can.
Okay, I'm a sex offender in California, and it's been, 10 years ago, and it's in 2011 I had my record expunged, but I still have to register. And recently I traveled to Pennsylvania. And when I got there, I had to register, and they put me on Megan's website. The problem with that is that when I'm in California, I don't have to. I got a letter saying that I don't have to be on the Megan's website. So isn't that a little, every time I travel to a different state, the rules are going to change.
That's a great question, and I probably won't be able to give you an answer that you'll like. The answer is that each state is a separate sovereign. Each state makes its own registration requirements, and anytime you go into a separate sovereign, whether or not California wants you on the website is irrelevant for that state. Because as far as I know, I think Pennsylvania puts everyone on the website, and I'm not sure about juveniles, but everyone who's registered as an adult goes on the website. And when you're in those states that put all their sex offenders on the website, you cannot argue that California controls, because California doesn't control. Pennsylvania controls, because it's a state by state regulatory scheme.
Yeah, I have I have really struggled with that here in Maryland with folks that are coming off because, you know, a lot of them are going, oh, yay, now I can move to, you know, fill in the blank, or now I can travel across the country, and I could say, slow down, because you're only off the list in Maryland. And, you know, you've got to still look at the laws in every other state. So it's not a get home free card that we're getting people off here in Maryland. It doesn't help your travel or your moving to another state at all.
Yeah, but I'm only there for 3 weeks.
If the state has a law that says you have to register after 3 days, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
That's the problem. Yeah.
Yeah, and some of the states you go to, they will never remove you from the website. You know, even after when you leave that temporary presence, like Florida, you visit Florida and you register, Florida will keep you on the website when you go back to California.
And that has been a problem to some people because they moved to some other state, and you know they were. I forget who it was. You may remember, Larry. Somebody had gotten off in one state, went to Florida somehow or other, stayed there too long, got registered down there, moved to some other state, and the state that they moved to said, well, you're registered in Florida, so we're going to register you here. We wouldn't normally, but you're registered in Florida. So, I mean, it is really critical to do your homework. I don't advise anybody to go to Florida. I mean, what if you end up in the emergency room, you know, and you're there too long? You have to register.
I don't advise anyone to break the law, but
no.
If you, I'll say this without giving advice. If you travel and you choose to register in these states, I mean, very few sex offenders are emitting radiation, so they're not going to know that you're there. When you cross state boundaries, they haven't got the technology up that they're working on to be able to integrate your license plate and snap it when you cross the line and run it through the database and see that you're a sex offender and start tailing you. Chances are you could go in and out of these states without being discovered. But if you choose to comply, and I tell people that, you know, that's your prerogative to do that. If you choose to comply, once you get on the state list, you may not ever get off. And the California has no control over what Pennsylvania did with you when you registered there as a visitor. And did they remove you? Do you know if they removed you from their website when you returned to California?
Yeah, they do.
They do. Okay. Well, that's good to know. But yeah, they put you public, and there's nothing you can do about it.
But now I see some public information on my identity guard that's showing up. My sex offender offense is showing up with the wrong address and everything as a public record that it wasn't there before. So because I visited the state, that information is now showing up. I can't even find out how to get rid of it.
So, it's
expunged. The record's expunged, you know.
Well, no, your criminal record but your registration record is what they're putting up there, and your registration record is not expunged because you said that you still have to register.
Right, but can't they just say, well, I'm a registered sex offender, but they're actually putting the actual court.
Well, they're putting the information that you're giving them when you register about your conviction, or if you're not giving it to them, they're putting information they're getting from the court. You know, from the agency that you're registered with. I misspoke. I didn't say the court, but didn't mean to say the court, but the agency you're registered with. They're putting that information, but that's not something that I'm going to be able to give you encouraging news about. When you register in Pennsylvania, you know, they put you on the website. I would be very careful about what states you go to because the majority of them are going to put you on the website if you register. The majority are.
Yeah. Where do we get that information from, the Megan's Law website of the state?
That's one place. People always they chastise me when I suggest it, but
that's why I was not going to say it.
Well, I'm going to go ahead and say it because it's a convenient location. You can actually go to it's sort of a victim advocacy website called Klaas Kids, KLAAS Kids, and they it's not perfect up to date, but they actually do try to keep up to date the latest laws in particular states. And I guess it's supposed to make the victim's parents or, you know, the parents feel more comfortable or something about what's going on in a state. But it has an advantage that you can at least see roughly what's going on in a particular state. The only absolute, and even then you can get screwed over, is to literally find a phone number and call.
It's on that website, Brenda. If you click on the state, there's a contact number on there, and you can call.
There's a contact number on there, and you can see what they've most recently researched. But the only way to be absolutely sure is to actually call where you're going to and say, look, you know, I'm traveling through. I want to stay compliant. What's the law there? And
did
get
you
it.
Spell that again slower?
KLAAS is in Sam. Cloth Kids. KIDS. And I think it's .org. Is it .org, Larry?
I'm not sure. I haven't gone there lately.
If you Google Cloth Kids, it'll come up though.
So yeah, no.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I've been chastised. Oh, how can you give that out? And okay, yeah, but sorry, nobody on this side has managed to keep it as up to date. So it's the best we've got.
It still seems like punishment to me.
Oh, it definitely is.
No one on our side has told you that it's not.
Mm-mm. Nope.
The issue is, and I forgot your name already. But the issue is that a law is presumed constitutional upon enactment, and the challenging party bears the burden of showing by clear and convincing evidence that the law is not constitutional. So when these laws are signed by your friendly governors and passed by the people that you elect to your assemblies, they are presumed valid. And if a challenge doesn't assert itself, and if we don't show by the clearest of proof that the law is unconstitutional, it survives the challenge. And every law has originally been challenged in most states was 10 or more years old before they added all these enhancements on them, and there haven't been any recent challenges in most states. Now, in Maryland and the states I named off earlier, like Oklahoma, Kansas, Indiana, Maine, Alaska, there have been some more recent challenges based on the current version of the law, and in many cases, it's being found to be punishment. But in California, they haven't found that registration scheme as punishment. Pennsylvania is in litigation right now. Matter of fact, there was a decision that we talked about on our last call that came from their intermediate court of appeals. It's not their top court, and the issue of the 2012 Pennsylvania law will ultimately end up in the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and maybe we'll get a similar outcome that we got from Maryland. But it's punishment until a court says it's not, and we have to prove that. We have to develop the case. We have to take it through the system. We have to fund it, and we have to prove it. I'm sure most people didn't want to hear that. So.
All right. Does anybody else have any questions?
Yeah, we're going to get on the rest of the program because we got one more thing to cover, which is what Arsenal and National is doing.
So why don't we go ahead and at least Larry, I think that this last section is mostly yours. Let me real quickly. Ed popped back in. Let's see if this is a quick question because he was online for this last topic. So let me just check real quick. Ed, you're the one.
Larry, this is Ed from Florida.
Hello, from Florida.
Can you tell me what the date was for this Adam Walsh or Megan's Law or when it was all enacted?
Well, I don't know what you mean by it all.
I have to register for life, okay? And my probation ended in 98.
So you were retroactively changed at some point to a longer term based on some iteration of a state law of your state law there.
I was convicted in another state. I just live in Florida, and I have to register in Florida. So
Well, Florida, like most southern states, is really on the really heavy requirement side of doing things that. I would have to do some research to tell you how many times and what years the Florida law has been amended. But everybody obsesses over the Adam Walsh Act. The Adam Walsh Act is not your problem unless your state names your law after the Adam Walsh Act. Your problem is your state registration requirements, and Florida SORNA or whatever they call it is your problem. And I don't know that there's been any litigation challenging. Florida's original registry was not lifetime.
I didn't have to register until I resided physically in Florida until 2009. Before that, I was with the other state, and the only requirement I had to make sure of is that I told the local sheriff's department that I was an SO.
So that'll be something that we would need to talk about further off this call, because we would take a lot of unpacking to do.
The other question I have is recently, I'm a veteran. I'm an honorably discharged military veteran. So, and I use the VA, Veterans Administration. And some of the bases here in Florida, they've put and said they would not allow SOs on. So therefore, there goes my VA health care, because I can't get on the installation to go to the clinic.
That sounds like a challenge waiting to happen, but that would be another one we probably can't really deal with today.
Yeah.
I would be interested to know what his local congressperson would say about that.
Yeah.
Have you called your congressional office?
I have not.
They pay lip service to how greatly they appreciate the veterans and how they deserve their care, and I would be interested to know. I mean, I doubt they would do anything for you, but I'd be interested to know what your congressperson would say. Where are you in Florida?
Up in Panhandle.
So
just north of Panama City.
Yeah, I don't know who your congressperson is for their.
It was Sutherland until he lost, but now I think it's Glenn Graham.
But yeah, feel free to contact me off the call here in terms of the registration sort of questions. I may can direct you to someone. Can you do that?
Sure. You want me to wait over after this?
Yeah, that's fine.
Sure.
Because I want to before everyone leaves, go into to what the RSL National is doing, and we've got some exciting things to report.
Okay.
Has anybody left on the call, Brenda?
The one jumped on, but is anybody left on the call? Yes, yes, we do.
Okay.
I do have one person waiting on Q&A, but I think we need to go ahead and let you. At least do a quick report.
Any questions that people have after I do the program. So if people want to hang on with questions, I'll stay until there are no other questions. But
okay.
I do want to get to the announcements of what RSOL. You guys get email, and practically everyone on this call does receive emails. You saw we went to the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers annual meeting in Las Vegas last month. And we had the association has this workshop. This was our fifth annual, and there's going to be another one next year about the same time. And attorneys from all over the country were there that defend those accused of sex crimes. And 475 attorneys registered for the conference. And RSOL had an exhibit there. We had our literature. We had books written by one of our members. We had great banners, and it just was a beautiful table and stuff we did there. And we talked to a lot of people, and we recruited some members who joined RSOL as members of the organization. And at this point, they are members. They're warm to what we're doing because they were there because they defend people who are accused of sex crimes, including SORNA violations. And so I learned a lot. I actually registered and attended most of the conference and worked at the table when I could to help out John, who was working with us. But we think that we're going to ultimately translate that into attorneys who will be available to take referrals and possibly work with us on amicus in states where we can generate new litigation. That's the goal of doing this. We're not just going to for the sake of going to a conference. We're hoping to build the bridge and let these people know that there's an organization out there that works entirely on this issue. And we hope to build a network of attorneys. And I think we got 9 or 10 out of the who joined RSOL, and we're going to send out a follow-up solicitation to the other 400 something that didn't join, and try to see if we can get more members. And as we integrate them into our membership, and as we begin to communicate with them, and they see all our email traffic of things we're doing, we're going to hope that they are available for doing work. But it's not an instantaneous thing. We're not going to be able to release the names of our members who just simply joined as members right now and tell everybody that, you know, so we've gotten some requests from people saying, who joined RSOL at the conference? Well, at this point, we're not able to say that until we confer with them and figure out the parameters of what they want to do, if they can take referrals, if they're interested in having their names known as members of RSOL. And a couple of them work for public defender agencies, and they cannot take referrals because the people that they help have to be within their service area and have to be economically qualified. So we will have more to report to you on the NACDL as time unfolds, but it was a success, and that everybody that attended our exhibit had never heard of us. They didn't know such an organization was in existence. So that's one exciting thing that we're doing. We have decided where we're going to hold our next annual conference, and we scoured the world, certainly the United States, from coast to coast, and we identified the location of Dallas, Texas, for our next conference. So if there's any Texans on the line here, we're going to be needing you to help us. Especially, we're going to be people from other states as well. But anyone from Texas, we're coming to Dallas next year to hold our 2015. What number of conference is that, Brenda? Seven?
I think it is. Uh-huh.
So that's in the planning stages, and we're hoping to announce that formally in writing. But it was just recently decided the location. So that's a good thing. We're planning on putting out an annual report of some type to our membership about what we've accomplished in the last year, and some of the things we talked about tonight will be in the annual report. And you know, that I can't give you a timeline, but it'll certainly hopefully be in the next 90 days or so, in the first quarter of 2015. Those are the big things I wanted to talk about. Was there anything that I didn't cover, Brenda, that National is doing? I know there's a whole bunch of smaller projects that we're working on in terms of trying to regionalize, and we're trying to get recruit more people from across the country to partner with us on things, and we're trying to recruit members and all this kind of stuff. But is there anything that's going on?
I think the one other thing I would mention that we're gearing up for during the coming few months is our LEO project. We're working on a law enforcement only registry project with the goal of getting people not listed. Part of that project will involve coming up with some sample legislation, have a video that can be shared with lawmakers and others, just a whole package deal, and then folks, advocates from different states can take that and customize it for the audience that they're approaching in their state. It's still in the early stages, but we're starting to put things together and making regular progress on that. So that'll be a big deal as we move along, I hope.
Now, you mean, Brenda, you guys are not going to just try to abolish the registry in one fell swoop?
We've certainly gotten some interesting comments on that already. Our opinion is that registries just don't work. But the reality is that if you are approaching a lawmaker, the reality is that you're simply not going to convince lawmakers to dismantle it. And so a slightly more realistic goal is to say, hey, you know, you'll get just as much bang for your buck and a whole lot less trouble with these pesky lawsuits and things like that if you just take the darn thing back offline like maybe you had in the beginning and let law enforcement watch. It is a compromise just in terms of what, you know, we would like to have it go away. They would like to keep it. This is a compromise. But that's the logic behind it is you know, you're just not going to convince people to take it down entirely. It would be great, but it's not going to happen. So the other big goal, I think, of the LEO project is to simply get the message out there that what's out there right now doesn't work. It's not effective. It's a waste of money, and they need to be looking at alternatives. So even if nobody passes a law enforcement only registry as we've written it, hopefully we will have gotten the dialogue going and the discussion going and some media attention and just get the word out that something needs to change. So that's the other goal.
So, well, we are at our 90 minutes, and I've told people we can keep going with Q&A as long as, but mm-hmm. I want to make sure we covered the announcements and the agenda
sure.
items. But we can go back to Q&A.
Alrighty, I do have one person patiently waiting. If you like, I guess that means you like. I think
hello?
I'm taking her off.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I think I have you. There we go. Yes. You there?
We'll
try this again. According to my console, there's somebody off with the extension of 1701. But if you're not being heard, I'm not sure what's going on. Let me try this again. Okay.
Well, we heard the hello part, but that was all.
I did. I heard a hello, and I didn't hear anything else. Maybe I need to clear the queue and let the person star six themselves again because something weird's going on. The name, like I say, if you ended in 1701, and if anybody else wants and start again, because some must be a bug going on there. If you all have a question, just do star six again, and we'll try it again. Not sure we've got a technical glitch here. Definitely got a problem. Anything else you wanted to add, Larry, while we get this figured out?
I know
we still have a large number of people on the call. Otherwise, I'd just say, hey, let's, I'll just take everybody off.
I don't know if the large number of people, how many of them are mad at me now, but if there's any of that's not mad at me and you want to ask a question, I'm good at doing that. So if there's anybody that's not
Hello.
Mad at me, even if you are mad, go ahead.
There we are. I'm hearing a voice now.
There we are, back again. Michael from Indiana again. Hey, just Larry, real quick from Larry, I just wanted some contact information.
Okay. Now, I'm old-fashioned. I like to talk on telephones. Are you able to
okay.
do that?
Absolutely.
Because I'll give my number, and you can call me at my office, and I'm here at all hours of the day and night. It's 505-881-4475.
That's
and that
great.
Goes for
Thank
anyone
you.
Else. Now, when you call me, you'll get a recording if I'm not here that says that this is a business that doesn't say Larry Neely, but that's me on the recorder, so and I'll call you back.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other questions? I seem to have gotten that one to work, but I can, again, we could just clear this the Q&A session over, and I'll turn that off, and hopefully it won't get too crazy on here.
So, yeah, with the 40 people, they couldn't make that much noise.
All right.
Okay, welcome, everybody. Now everybody can hear everybody.
That's right.
Brenda,
all here.
Brenda, this is Richard. I think you're having problems with your Q&A thing. Because I was on it and got bumped off a couple times.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, me too, from Texas.
Well,
yeah.
I'm sorry to hear that, because definitely did not see either one of you, and then there was one person who showed up and then didn't
go
back.
We'll take your questions.
Me and I got bumped also. So
I decided to take it really personal.
Well, I'm so glad I took everybody off of mute.
I'm
what's
not
that phone number again?
Larry, are you there? Larry's number?
Yeah, that was a 505 number, right, from New Mexico?
Uh-huh. 505-881-4475.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Hey, Larry?
I've definitely got a problem with my console, because I've taken everybody off mute, and according to my console, everybody is still muted. So, I've got an issue. I'm sorry,
well,
guys.
You know, there's lots of people who'd probably like to mute me, but
I wouldn't have picked on you that much.
So how would you be able to take more questions here? Because we won't know who's got their hand up. But yeah, I'll try to take the questions.
I have a question.
Who's I?
This is Ellen. Ellen from Texas.
Okay, Ellen.
Yes, I was very interested in the question about religion earlier on in the conversation about church attendance. I'm in Texas. My son will be getting out probably this time next year on parole. I'm wondering is that a specific requirement for each individual parole case, or is anybody else on here from Texas? Do you know if that's pretty much standard, that you can't go to church unless you are given permission by whoever, parole board, or not parole board, but parole person?
By your supervising agency.
So in Texas, you can't just automatically go to church without permission. Is that what you're saying?
You almost have to have a chaperone contract in place.
Okay.
Okay. Okay. What is the authority that says that?
The state of Texas.
Okay, what is it a state law, or is it a rule? Where does the authority come from?
It's a state law. It's
in Connecticut, by the way, it's a probation condition.
Okay, now that's different than a state law.
No,
that's what
but
I was wondering. If you
are on the registry, they can do pretty much whatever they want, and every agency can make their own rules.
But we're talking about a supervised offender here. Her question is about a supervised offender.
Right.
And then the person piped up and said that's the rule for everybody in Texas. And I'm asking, what is the authority for that? Is that a state law, or is that a rule of an agency? And if so, what agency has that rule?
It is a state law. It's Section 62, something or other, 01. And then every agency, every municipality can make their own extra rules up as they care to. Because I'm on the registry.
So if my son wanted to go to church, he merely needs to ask permission rather than, if it's not stated on his parole, his particular parole requirements, like ABC, you know, 1, 2, 3, if it's not on there, you're saying that he needs to ask someone for permission before he goes to church?
You know what? It would be probably the very best thing he could do before
he
gets himself in more trouble.
I can give some objective response to the question, since I deal with so
Great.
Many guys that are on the registry and do residential reentry for guys in Texas in Fort Worth. My experience and observation is that you're going to see that the parole officer's primary concern is child safety zones.
Right.
And
absolutely.
And so, you know, when they're on paper, they are pretty much under the thumb of parole, and it really is done on an individual basis. Our residential reentry program has a relationship with a covering church that parole, for the most part, has allowed all of our men to attend without question because that church has policies and procedures in place, and they know that dynamically those men are going to be separated from contact with children. And
right.
So, you know, but not every church is willing, not every church is a good dynamic. You know, I've also had a lot of problems in the past and had parole, you know, basically shut the door. We went 9 months without any of our guys being able to go to a church.
Well, my church has already stated that they will welcome him in. Would that help to get that statement first and then take it to the parole officer?
What they're typically looking for is the person to disclose, and for the pastor to provide a letter stating disclosure, and that the church has said that they've established boundaries so that, you know, they're aware and letting, you know, parole know that they're aware and have policies and procedures in place. And if the parole officer is really concerned because perhaps the individual is considered a moderate risk or a high risk, then a lot of times what I've seen is that they end up having to have a chaperone who's been certified through treatment. And, you know, so sometimes they have guys that are under those conditions. And if their chaperone's not there, guess what? They're not going to church.
Yeah.
You know, there's no substitutes. And
I got it. Thank you. All of that has helped me a lot. Thank you very much.
If I can give a little bit of input, too, I'm not in Texas, but I'm on parole in Indiana. And what I've found is that if I can get a protection plan approved through my therapist and get a minister, somebody to sign off on that protection plan, that's always helpful. If I put in writing the specific steps that I'm taking to protect me, who's going to be the chaperone type of people, and then get a church to sign off on that. And also I found that if they won't let you go to a church service, that's a lot to let you go to a men's group.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for adding that piece, because typically part of a parole deal.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, sorry again, guys.
Hey, Larry.
I obviously had no idea that everybody was having trouble. So,
sorry about that, everybody.
The main speaker we just heard, is that Larry Neely?
Yes.
Well, I'm the moderator. I don't know if you call me the main speaker, but yeah, I've been doing a lot of speaking.
The person who talked the most.
Well, that would be me.
Okay. No, that's fine.
I have a question when it clears.
Okay.
I'm in Michigan. My daughter took a no contest plea for accosting a minor. Moved to Florida, of course, had to register there. But they don't even recognize accosting a minor. They don't have that on their record as being a charge necessarily.
As a registrable offense.
I'm sorry?
As a registrable offense.
Right, yeah. Right. So
in
Florida, it's not considered that's not listed on their registrable offenses. But
right,
I guess
correct.
They put a parallel one on there, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because she had to register because she's on the list here in Michigan. So, of course, when she moved to Florida, she had to register, but that's not – they didn't even know what that was when she went to the police department. What are you talking about? No. So she's in the process of getting it expunged here. We have an attorney. But obviously that won't take her off the list in Florida now, even though that isn't even something they recognize. That's just bizarre to me.
Mm-hmm. That's the problem.
When you say expunged, there's a lot of people misuse the term expunged.
Mm-hmm.
There's various things. First of all, there's no such thing as a true expungement because the FBI, the NCIC, they never let go of anything that they have in their system. But there's various levels of expungement. There's an expungement that merely shields it from view of the public. And thank you, Brenda. And then there's
trying to clear this up.
There's expungement where the state itself removes it from its databases because most states, including Michigan, has the state version of the NCIC. But then people misuse the word expungement when they mean there are things called pardons.
there's things where a person's gotten clemency, they've been forgiven for the action, and then that's if the conviction never happened. So you would need to really unpack that depending on what your goals are. If she's trying to get back to Michigan and doesn't have to register in Michigan, that ends a lot of her problems, but it doesn't take her off the Florida list because she got registered in Florida. So
she's registered in Michigan. She was charged in Michigan.
I got that part, but you said you're about to get her expunged, and I assumed that meant that she would no longer have a registration obligation the way you use the term expunge. Would she still, after she gets this expungement, would she still have to register if she was in Michigan?
No, but she would still be, she would still be on the list because they said they're going to try for an expungement, and then they would go for getting her off the list because they're two separate things just because you get
for deregistration.
Okay, so if she can return to Michigan after getting this thing that you're calling an expungement done, that would relieve her of her registration obligation, but still she would be on the list in Florida, which is something that would have to be unpacked with a Florida attorney. I don't know of any successful cases getting people off that list once they've been on it, but then again, I'm not in direct contact with Florida. We do have some contacts in Florida with legal professionals that might, if that's your goal. If your goal is to try to fight whether or not, see, there's so many different things you could be doing. Of your goals, if you're trying to fight whether or not she'd be required to register in Florida, then there again, you need a Florida legal professional to unpack this because Florida may have language that she's only registering because she's required to register in Michigan. If she's no longer required to register in Michigan, it's possible that Florida, if they don't have an equivalent offense, would deregister her as well. I don't know the answer to that, but you've got a lot of unpacking to do to resolve this, and you have to know exactly what your goals are. And I'm good at plotting strategy once I have a person who knows what it is they're trying to do, what they're trying to accomplish. So.
Well, you know, the problem is that this, whenever they go to get a job or an application or anything, of course, that they have to put down, yes, I was charged with this. Whereas if it's expunged, my understanding is it wouldn't come up on the, like if they did a background check, it wouldn't come up. Is that correct? When there's an expungement?
That's generally true if it's a true expungement. The public on an expungement doesn't see it. Now, the cops would be able to see it.
Right.
So if she were to, like, apply for a daycare job or something where an FBI background check, the FBI would certainly know that this happened.
Oh, yes, right, yeah, and that wouldn't be the case. She also has a job where she has to fly, she might have to fly quickly, which, once again, that is an issue, you know. She can't do that because of
her registration.
Yes.
So, well, like I say, if you sharpen and focus what your goals are, I can probably direct you to some resources in Florida, and you'll probably need resources in both states. You hear that ka-ching, ka-ching, ka-ching going? But to fight, you're going to have a two-state battle because she's in Florida trying to get decoupled, and the reason why she's apparently registering in Florida is because of her Michigan conviction. And,
correct.
So you've got a couple of battles to fight.
There is an attorney in Florida who has been on, I don't know, one of the stations, who has actually gone to battle for some of these people who he felt shouldn't be on the list and won the case, several of them actually.
So, well, that would be definitely a good lead to contact him if you
right.
know that attorney.
Yeah.
I mean, I do. We have contact with some attorneys that have come to our conference in Los Angeles from Florida. So mm-hmm. we have some contacts. But if you know someone who's been successful, that'd be the place to start.
Okay, I'm going to
tell you what. One of the things I would say is, if you have this contact base, share it with RSOL.
Okay. Well, I get it. Yep, I will do that. I just want to get your phone number correct, Mr. Neely, because I tried to write it down and I wasn't sure I got it correct.
505-881-4475.
Got it?
505-881-4475.
Thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Hey, Larry?
Hey.
Yep. Mark from Connecticut. You and I have had a number of conversations about, I hate to say the word state shopping, but I'm trying to reduce my footprint, if you would. And we talked about those states that would give me information as to whether I would need to register. And interestingly enough, Massachusetts, New York, Delaware all said, and among a couple others, said I would have to go there first before they would evaluate me. Texas gave me approval, and believe it or not, New Mexico gave me approval. So that was the piece for you was New Mexico. We thought wasn't going to give me an answer, and they did. Actually, I got the answer today.
Let me ask you real quick. Approval for what?
To move from registration? I'm a resident of Connecticut moving, and I will not have to register upon my arrival in either Texas or New Mexico based on my offense because there's not a corresponding offense.
He's asking for a determination. New Mexico doesn't register you simply because you're registered in another state. You have to fit.
Most states do, but New Mexico gave me an affirmative that my offense does not match up to theirs.
Yeah, we have to have an equivalency determination of whether it's an equivalent.
Wow.
And that's one of the loopholes that's in our law that the governor will probably try very hard to close in 2015 because of people like him.
I spent hundreds of hours on this. About 50 of Larry's.
So, I'd like to see the letter from DPS. So let's court. You've got my email. We've communicated many times. So.
I have your phone number. I do not have your email, but I have another question that's probably best suited offline. So I'll give you a call and get your email address when I. It'll be a couple of days.
Okay.
Well, we still have a number of people hanging on. Is there anybody that's on the call that has not spoken that maybe had a question earlier on and unfortunately was not getting through?
Well, I know you may be surprised at this, Brenda, but this is Richard. I haven't spoken.
I'm very surprised. I'm surprised, but not because... Not knowing what I know now, which is that I never saw your name show up.
Yeah, Mike. Just a quick question, Larry. Is there a date to the meeting next year in Dallas?
Oh, the conference.
The conference.
Yes, there is. And at the moment, I'm not in front of a calendar, but I'll get myself in front of one. It's the last week of June, Thursday, Friday, Saturday of June.
That's the 25th through the 27th, I think.
Yes.
You were going to start on a Thursday and run through Saturday, Sunday? That's
Saturday.
25th.
Yeah,
you got a calendar right here. What day is the 4th of July?
July 4th?
This is Saturday.
It's a week later after we end the conference.
All right. Very good. I just wanted to... Thinking about my geek schedule, that's all. Good.
Will it be at the same church as last July?
Yes.
Great.
We searched the country for a location, and we found that church.
Again.
Perfect.
That's fantastic. I love that. I have a question or a comment or something to throw out there. And...
Who's this, please?
Yeah, this is Greg.
Okay.
And I'm on the registry, and I've already finished my SOTP and everything else, and then my local folks threw me back on a third-degree felony for failure to register for being a day late.
Oh. Great.
When they told me they wouldn't. I'm not impressed. But my SOTP provider told me that might not preclude me from being able to go ahead and finish the deregistration process for myself.
What state are you in?
Texas.
Okay. Now, when you say they hit you with a felony, has the case been resolved?
It's been resolved, and I went with a plea bargain on it, which means I probably can't ever back it out.
How long ago was it resolved?
Yeah, a year or so.
Have you completed your obligations for the third degree felony? Are you done, or are you still on paper?
I'm still on paper.
Okay, so I think it would be a safe bet that you will not be deregistered while you're being. Oh God, I'm going to be such an unpopular guy tonight because this is a really good question. I maintain that no one should ever plead guilty to violating the registry on very weak cases, such as what you just described for being a day late. Because once you do that, you have set yourself up for a lifetime on the registry. There is no way that you're going to be removed after having been convicted for violating the very thing that you're asking to be removed from complying with. I will make you that bet that any lawyer that you get to help you, the question you ask that lawyer, say, have you ever got a person off of registration, deregistered, through this deregistration process that was convicted of having been convicted of violating the registry during their term of registration? And you let me know, my phone number's out there. You call me back and tell me that they say yes to that question.
Because you are not expecting to hear that answer.
I know I won't, but if you can find a lawyer that has got a person, make sure you hear the question that you want to ask. Have you successfully removed a person from registration through the deregistration process, not through some other claim that doesn't relate to that, but through a process that's provided in law after a particular period of time on registry? Have you removed a person from registration that has been convicted of violating the registry? And I look forward to you calling me back and telling me if you can find a lawyer who successfully petitioned a person off who was convicted of violating it. Now, I can tell you that you might be removed for constitutional grounds, like in Maryland. Everybody who of these 3,000 that may get off, some of them may have taken pleas for violating the registry. But if they never were supposed to be on it to begin with, they're going to still come off because of constitutional concerns, not because they met some deregistration obligation. But if you have violated the registry, I don't think it's very good odds that you're going to get off.
Yeah, that's something.
Well, here's my approach, and you just give me your quick take on it. Is I was never shown the evidence against me for a child pornography conviction. So if I was never shown the evidence against me, how on earth can I possibly work in my own defense with my defender?
Well, and I don't know how many years ago your pornography conviction happened, but the rules have changed in the last decade in terms of discovery. Normally, all discovery is provided to defense attorney, and the discovery is the evidence that the state or the federal government will introduce.